Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be talking to Yael Hersonsky. She is a filmmaker. Her new documentary is called A Film Unfinished, and it's about Nazi propaganda and the Warsaw Ghetto. I'm delighted now to welcome James W. Lowen. He's the author of many books, including Lies My Teacher Told Me and Teaching What Really Happened. He's been on the program before, and he's a co-editor of the new book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About America's Lost Cause. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
I'm happy to be on with you.
So this is a collection of original source materials about secession and the Civil War. Why did you decide to put this book together?
Well, first of all, it's timely. I mean, it is coming upon, as of Christmas Eve, actually, 150 years, otherwise known as the sesquicentennial, since South Carolina led this parade out of the Union exactly 150 years ago on Christmas Eve. But I had another reason that's more important. For the last 3 years or so, I have been doing large workshops for teachers, owing to the success of my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, and maybe of my newer book, Teaching What Really Happened. And these workshops have been all over the country. And I typically ask teachers, why did the South secede? I always get four answers. And the four answers are slavery, states' rights, because the election of Lincoln, and tariffs and taxes, or issues about tariffs and taxes. And then I say, I have my little one-liner, I say, well, let's vote on this. But this is not Chicago. You can only vote once. Right. And so they all laugh. And then we vote. And no matter where I am, states' rights wins. States' rights wins, hands down, 60 to 75% of the vote. This happens in southern Florida, happens in southern California, happens in North Dakota, Cleveland, a largely black audience in Memphis, Tennessee, etc. So then I say, okay, well, is that how we do history? Majority rules? Well, no, no, they say we need evidence. And so I ask them, oh, what would be good evidence? And they start out by saying things like, well, newspapers. And I say, well, yeah, how about the Portland Oregonian from 1991? They said, no, 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 newspapers from the time, you know, and so on, and from the place. And pretty soon, somebody, and we talk about primary documents, I mean, they're exactly right on track already, and pretty soon somebody says, well, didn't South Carolina have a convention when they decided to secede? And didn't this convention publish a statement as to why? And, of course, they did, and that's one of the I would submit that's the most important single document in this book. The title of it is Declaration of the Immediate Causes Which Induce and Justify the Secession of South Carolina from the Federal Union. That sounds on point.
Exactly. And what this document shows is that states' rights were part of it, but it's the exact opposite of what they thought.
States' rights, yeah, were not part of it. They were the opposite in a way. Can I read from it?
Please.
They have a kind of a bogus constitutional history of the U.S. for a page or two, and then they get to why we are seceding. And here's what they say. Quote, we assert that 14 of the states have deliberately refused for years past to fulfill their constitutional obligations, and we refer to their own statutes for the proof. The Constitution, now that sounds a little vague, but they go right on to tell us what they're talking about. The Constitution of the United States, in its fourth article, provides as follows, quote, no person held to service or labor in one state, under the laws thereof, escaping into another, shall, in consequence of any law or regulation therein, be discharged from such service or labor, but shall be delivered up on claim of the party to whom such service or labor may be due. Well, that's beginning to sound like slavery, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
And then they go on to talk about states' rights. And in fact, they list the states and they list the rights that really upset them. And it turns out they're against states' rights. They list some 16 states, quote, the states of Maine, New Hampshire, Vermont, Massachusetts, Connecticut, blah, 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 Illinois, Indiana, Wisconsin, and Iowa have enacted laws which either nullify the acts of Congress or render useless any attempt to execute them. Now, what's going on is that states like Pennsylvania, for instance, they don't really like the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. It's the most draconian federal law that's been passed up until that point. It, among other things, it requires that if, let's say, if you are African American, or I claim you are, and you're in southern Pennsylvania, and I'm a white slave owner, or I claim I am, if I'm Baltimore maybe, and I say, stop her, she's my slave, she's escaped, then anybody in the sound of my voice, anybody on the street, if we're in a building, anybody in the store or whatever, is duty-bound to help me hold you under this act. And if anybody is a law enforcement person, a JP or a deputy sheriff or a state police or whatever, then they're supposed to help me track you down just on my say-so. And your goose is actually cooked, because when we get you to court, we go to a special federal court. You may, in fact, say, wait a minute, I'm not only not his slave, I'm not anybody's slave. I'm a free African-American person, been living in Pennsylvania. Makes no difference, because you can't testify in federal court against a white person. So anyway, Pennsylvania says, well, we don't really like this act. It's making us all complicit in slavery. We're trying to be a free state. We realize we can't secede. We realize we can't nullify. But, you know, we do have the right to do a few things. Like, for instance, we have the right to pay our policemen and decide when we pay them. So you policemen, you deputy sheriffs, you do what you have to under this act. But we're not paying you for that time. Well, South Carolina is upset with this. South Carolina is upset with New York, because New York has denied what's called slavery transit. Now, this is the idea where, well, let's suppose that you and I are married and we're slave owners in Charleston, and we don't want to spend August in Charleston. We want to spend it out on Long Island, you know, or maybe watching plays in Broadway. But we don't want to do our own cooking, so we want to bring our cook along. Well, New York says, no, you can't do that. We're trying to run a free state. If you bring your enslaved cook in here, she becomes free. Well, South Carolina's enraged at that, and they're upset with the New England states because they let black folks vote. Now, who votes in America was a state's right until the 15th Amendment got passed 2 eras after this during Reconstruction. But nevertheless, South Carolina takes it upon itself to say, this is an outrage. So, in short, South Carolina is all against states' rights, and yet most of our teachers are teaching that they seceded for states' rights. It's just amazing.
And one of the things that points out is something which I think is so relevant to the political discourses which we have today, is that there's a really big difference between facts and opinions. So when you have a bunch of people vote on why did the South secede or why did South Carolina secede from the Union, it turns out that that's actually the answer to that question is a fact. It's not an opinion. So voting on it is irrelevant. And what your book does is provides documents, primary sources.
You got the facts, even if you don't like them.
Yeah, exactly. And basically, the short answer is they seceded because of slavery.
Exactly. Now, the few people, it's usually about 2% or 3% who answer the election of Lincoln, one of the four reasons. That's not wrong, and the documents, including South Carolina's and all the other states, incidentally, have documents too, and we collected them all. Well, many of them do mention the election of this sectional president. But why are they against Lincoln? So that's a right answer. But why are they against Lincoln? Well, they go on to say, because he's against slavery. So it's always slavery.
You write in your wonderful introduction to this book, we're talking about the book The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, you write about how history textbooks often use few or no quotations from original sources. And you have some examples, like there's this quotation from Alexander Stevens and other Confederate leaders. What did they actually say at the time about slavery and about race?
Yeah, it's not only slavery. I'm glad you say about slavery and about race. Because slavery and white supremacy, otherwise known as race, are intertwined, and you can't separate them. And if you weren't going to quote the South Carolina document, which you ought to quote, then the most famous document, really, is called the Cornerstone Speech. And this was made by Alexander Stevens. He had just been elected the vice president of the Confederacy. It's 3 weeks into his taking office. He gave it in front of thousands of people in Savannah, Georgia. And here's what the cornerstone, here's the high point of the speech. He says, quote, well, first of all, he badmouthed the founders because they made a fundamental error. They believed in the rights of man, that is, kind of notion of equality and stuff. He says, quote, our new government is founded upon exactly the opposite idea. Its foundations are laid. its cornerstone rests upon the great truth that the Negro is not equal to the white man, that slavery, subordination to the superior race, is his natural and moral condition. And he goes on, this, our new government, is the first in the history of the world to be based on this great philosophical, physical, and moral truth. That's pretty clear.
Indeed it is. And the fundamental philosophical difference between that and all men are created equal and endowed with certain inalienable rights and so on, which is what we learned in elementary school, could not be further apart. And the point that you make as the book goes on is that after the Civil War, the South lost, slavery was abolished, these ideas still had a very deep hold on the American psyche, including in the North.
The fallback position is, well, we have to maintain white supremacy. And of course, after Reconstruction, they did. I mean, the end of Reconstruction is the overthrow of the interracial Republican governments by the white supremacist Democrats. Now, this too blows people's minds. The white supremacist Democrats, they're the party of white supremacy. It's kind of the opposite of today. But yes, in the 19th century and clear into the 1920s, the Democratic Party called itself the white man's party. And, of course, they overthrew using KKK tactics. Indeed, it was the original Ku Klux Klan. They overthrew the interracial Republican governments. And then in 1890, beginning in Mississippi, they set about passing new constitutions so that there could never be an interracial government again, because blacks could never be citizens, could never vote and be on juries and so on after these new constitutions passed. We include these documents, too. That's why we call it the Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, because the Confederate ideology didn't just vanish in April of 1865 when the war ended. Indeed, our most recent document comes from 2008.
We're talking to Jim Loewen about his new book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About America's Lost Cause. And so tell us about this neo-Confederate response. First of all, what do you mean by neo-Confederate, and what did the neo-Confederates actually start doing in terms of revising history?
Well, neo-Confederates simply mean people who have the Confederate viewpoint, who laud the Confederates and so on, but aren't the original folks. And so we really have to start using the term certainly by maybe 1890. And so we have a whole chapter called The Nader, in which we study what the neo-Confederates said during the nadir, the what, a lot of people would say? Well, the nadir of race relations is a whole era that most historians know about, but most lay people don't even know the term. It begins in 1890, and it ends around 1940. And during this era, the U.S. went more racist than at any other time, even than during slavery. Now, I don't mean to be saying, well, it was better to be black in, say, 1858 than it was in 1908. No, nothing was good about slavery. But I do mean to say, for example, in 1858, no whites could say, well, those black folks are down at the bottom of the heap. They're poor and all, despite the fact that slavery is a equal opportunity system, despite the fact that they've got possible upward mobility, because everybody knew that slavery offered no upward mobility, well, almost none. There's maybe ways you could sleep your way to freedom, so to speak, but it's very, very difficult. In 1908, people could say that. You know, these black folks have been free for one, maybe two generations since 1865, and they're still the janitors. They're still the poorest people. They're still the outcasts. And it must be their own damn fault. And so that's pretty much what folks said, North as well as South.
And they say that to this day. I've heard well-educated people say that in the 21st century.
Today. Now, so therefore, the neo-Confederates certainly said it. And they said, this proves that we were right, and so on. So their whole argument goes on unchecked. Well, then, of course, we do get the Civil Rights Movement, which does help a whole lot. And now, the neo-Confederates, in their newest incarnation, they now argue, well, see, it not only wasn't about slavery, it wasn't even about white supremacy. And we can prove this because there's all kinds of black folks who fought on our side. And so Governor Sonny Perdue, for instance, in the most recent document in the book, the Confederate History Month proclamation for the year 2008, he says, you know, proclamations always have a bunch of whereases. And so he says, Whereas among those who served the Confederacy were many African Americans, both free and slave, who saw action in the Confederate armed forces in many combat roles. Well, that flatly did not happen. And one reason it didn't happen is because the Confederate government wouldn't let it happen. It was 3 weeks before the end of the Confederacy before they finally allowed blacks to be in the Confederate armed forces. And so it just flatly couldn't have happened. And you can always stop people making this argument by saying, well, gee, you know, tell me the name of a single Confederate unit of black troops. And they can't. They've never heard of one.
This brings us back to the subject of the teaching of history. You have the history with all these original documents. You have this revisionist neo-Confederate history. What do you see among high school teachers and college professors? What do they know about this material? What are they teaching?
Well, unfortunately, most high school teachers haven't read these documents, even though the South Carolina document in particular that I read from is maybe the, you could argue it's the third or maybe fourth most important document in the history of the country. But they haven't read it. What they have read is their textbooks. And the textbooks have the darndest way of not quoting the documents. They don't quote any documents. I actually have one textbook that has two whole paragraphs on the famous Cross of Gold speech by William Jennings Bryan, and it never quotes him except three words, Cross of Gold. Instead, it has these two boring paragraphs written in the usual textbook monotone about it. So that's one reason why they never quote it. And I think the other reason is because we have so mislearned this history that the original documents have now become controversial. And so it is controversial to claim that the Confederacy was all about slavery, even though the Confederacy said it was all about slavery.
Well, I think one of the subtexts of this is the major problem that we have to this day of race in America. It's
sure.
One of the central issues, and people haven't grappled with it yet. Some people have, many people haven't. And so, I mean, as you say in the introduction to your book, it's hard to sell a textbook in many states that says what the original, just takes quotations out of the original documents saying that this was about slavery and that this was about white supremacy.
That's absolutely correct. And the simple fact that 70% of our teachers are misteaching it today shows that we still have a long way to go in terms of race relations in America. I know we have a black president. I do read the newspapers. But we still have a long way to go in terms of race relations in America. And the fact that the textbooks are so obtuse, very few textbooks flatly say anymore the Confederate States seceded for states' rights. They just don't say why. I mean, only one of the 18 textbooks that I surveyed for my book, Lies My Teacher Told Me, quotes from any of these documents at all. And that one, which quotes from the key document, the South Carolina document, manages to do so by choosing a couple of sentences that don't say anything about slavery and therefore don't say anything about why they really seceded. Now, that's not easy. So it's just a cop-out by the textbook authors who imagine that nobody in South Carolina will identify their book if they will purchase their book if they are clear about why the South seceded. I don't really think the South is that backward, but the textbook publishers do, and that's who counts.
So it really is all about sales and marketing?
I'm afraid it is. And it's also about timidity. These folks are very timid. They don't want to offend anybody. And so they don't only not tell the truth about slavery, they don't tell the truth about a lot of things. I mean, well, let's put it this way. I spent a week this past summer in New Hampshire. I gave a workshop and so on. Now, New Hampshire has had exactly one president, and that's Franklin W. Pierce. Famous Franklin, who, you know? Franklin W. Pierce is my candidate for the second worst president in the history of the country. And I think I've got some good reason as to why. He was so bad that he's the only elected president whose party refused to renominate him, even though he wanted to be. Now, that's an achievement.
Right.
When he got off the train after coming back to New Hampshire, nobody even met it. I mean, that's how in disgrace he was. But that was in the 1850s. During the Nader, 1890 to 1940, I mean, he was terrible about race and about slavery. He was a totally pro-slavery, far-out pro-slavery Democrat. And, of course, New Hampshire's pretty far north for that. During the Civil War, he actually favored the Confederate cause and had to spend some time in England as a result. Okay, by 1940, all of that's been forgotten, and who cares about race relations anyway? And so now Franklin W. Pierce, well, they named a college for him, and, you know, he's got a nice historical marker because he's the only president after all that New Hampshire ever produced. So we don't want to tell the truth about Franklin W. Pierce. We don't want to say he's the second worst president in the history of the country, because then some school system in New Hampshire might not adopt our book. So let's just say that, you know, he was for states' rights. They make the claim. So it's not just the South. These idiot publishers don't want to offend anybody. And if you feel you can't offend anybody, you also can't say anything.
Well, it certainly makes one understand why a lot of students are bored by history, because, you know, you can, I mean, I remember being absolutely bored out of my mind trying to read high school textbooks. And looking back on it, there's this thing, this quality that almost all young people have, which is they can tell when they're being lied to. They don't know what the
truth. Some people say they have a crap detector.
Yeah, they do. Exactly. A BS detector. And if we make it into adulthood with that, we're in good shape. But even if they don't know what the truth is, they know that it's not that.
Yeah. All they learn, really, they don't. The basic theory, or, well, let's put it this way, the basic storyline of American history textbooks is we started out great and we've been getting better ever since.
Right.
And certainly, therefore, we don't do anything wrong and we never go backward. Well, you can't talk about the nadir of race relations when we got more racist, if that's your theme. You can't talk about things that we did bad on purpose, like, for instance, we committed treason, we seceded from the Union on behalf of slavery. We can't say that if we never did anything bad, and we does include the Confederates nowadays. So let's just not say much of anything at all. Well, the students don't conclude from that America never did nothing bad. I've never met a student who didn't come from a family that either told him that the Clinton administration did a bunch of bad things, or that the George W. Bush administration did a bunch of bad things. You know, nobody believes that these two administrations were both spotless. You can have a far right-wing Republican who only badmouths Clinton, or a far left-wing Democrat who only badmouths Bush, but you're not going to have anybody. So this is, the students don't go away believing, well, this is a perfect country. Instead, they go away believing that American history is perfectly boring.
Exactly. We're talking to Jim Loewen about his new book, The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About America's Lost Cause. The whole issue of states' rights is so abstract compared to moral issues like slavery or many other moral issues that we've been dealing with since. And why doesn't everybody just kind of see through that? When someone starts talking about state rights, you know there's something else underneath it.
Well, that's true. But what I want to point out is that it's worse than that, that Confederacy actually seceded because they were against states' rights, as the excerpt I read said. I was going to say implied, but it didn't imply it. It just directly said it. So it's not a matter of saying, well, states' rights is true, but it was states' rights on behalf of slavery. No, it's not even that close to true, because during the Buchanan administration, which, like the Pierce administration that had preceded it, was a far-out pro-slavery administration of the Democratic Party, the South, including South Carolina, had no complaint at all with Buchanan. And, of course, Jefferson Davis was Buchanan's Secretary of War, or Pierce's, and then became a senator. He had no complaint with either of those presidents. So the entire notion of states' rights, we just have to say, well, it wasn't for that. Now, some people will say, well, weren't they for the states' rights to secede, or the states' right to secede? Well, yes, but nobody secedes to secede. I mean, there is a reason why you secede. Seceding is what you do. It's not why you do it. So that's silly as well.
What would it take, do you think, for history to be taught truthfully? And what's your hope for this book?
I think it can be done. And I think that this is the year to do it. I mean, we're at the sesquicentennial, after all. We didn't get it right at the centennial. Let's do it now. And so my hope for this book is that a lot of people will buy it, and this is the first time I actually, well, no, it's not quite. It's the second time. I never hawk my books on the air. At least I never did for Lies My Teacher Told Me or Lies Across America. But this one I really hope folks will buy, It has the Confederate flag right on the cover, and it's called the Confederate Neo-Confederate Reader. You can't miss it. And then read it, but keep it nice. Take notes on the side on a separate piece of paper. And when you're done with it, then give it, it'll look like a new book, to your kid's history teacher in high school. And that'll get him or her on the right track and you know, have a little conversation with them. Say, look, we've got to change this. It's got to be taught right. And after you look at this, then give it to your colleagues. And my hope is we can really make a dent this year.
I think that the as we started to talk about before, this underlying question of race relations in America as such a central issue of our history that is kind of brushed under the rug or swept under the rug is also something that people have to deal with. And that's kind of the emotional component of this whole reading of history. There's a kind of denial. People don't, to some extent, in both the North and the South, don't really want to, and not just the textbook publishers, but ordinary people don't really want to look at the evidence.
That's true. And that was especially true during the Nader, 1890 to 1940. I mean, during that era, bad race relations were so common in the North that there's no way the North was going to mount much of a challenge as the South rewrites our history. So across the South, the Civil War starts getting known during that era as the war between the states. Nobody ever called it that while it was going on. And the notion that it was about slavery, well, let's just forget about that. Let's make it about states' rights. Of course, the problem is then the South comes out looking and smelling kind of wonderful, you know, the David against the Goliath of the federal government. It just wasn't like that. I mean, the Confederacy was at least as centralized as the United States during the Civil War. So it wasn't a David against Goliath type thing at all. And slavery, and for that matter, race relations, are not just this special interest of the NAACP or something. That it's part of the main trunk of our past, of our national history. And I think it's what we need to do is admit that and get it out in the open. And then we can actually move toward better race relations. I think there are even plenty of neo-Confederates, SCV types, you know, Sons of Confederate Veterans and so on, who are not really racist in their personal life, whose daughter may be dating an African-American or who live in an interracial neighborhood. But they want to honor their Confederate dead. Well, I submit we can honor them for their bravery, but we cannot honor them for their cause. We've got to change on that.
We're talking to Jim Loewen. He's the author of The Confederate and Neo-Confederate Reader, The Great Truth About America's Lost Cause. Jim, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me on.
Yeah.
I hope life is good for you. And I've always wanted to live in New Mexico, I think, but I never will, I guess.
Well, we hope you come visit. It would be wonderful if you could talk to some of our teachers here.
That would be nice. I don't know. That's New Mexico and Arizona are two of the three states that have not ever invited me.
Ah, well, we'll have to do
it's
something
an outrage,
about that.
Isn't it?
Teachers who are listening right now, contact me and we will make that. We will rectify that.
That'd be good.
Thanks.
All right.
Thanks so much, Jim.
Okay.
I'm very happy now to welcome Yael Hersansky. Her documentary film is called A Film Unfinished, and it opens this Friday, the 12th of November, at Regal de Vargas Cinema here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
This is a film about a film. And the older film is a black and white Nazi propaganda film shot in 1942. How did you come to make this documentary A Film Unfinished?
Well, it was 5-6 years ago, I began to think about the testimonial value of images, of historical footage. I was thinking about the time when no witnesses will be left to testify, to tell their memories, or even to be silent about the memories, but the survivors as witnesses are going to disappear from the world, and I thought that maybe it's the time to rethink or re-examine the witness that images that were documented mainly by the Nazis, what is the nature of this witness? And I approached an Israeli prominent producer that just finished that project in one of our Holocaust museums in Israel. And she gave me a basic list of footage I should maybe watch just at the beginning of my research. And among these films, I saw for the first time the 62-minute sequence, the unfinished propaganda film. And I think I was shocked not only by the intensity of the sequence, but also by the fact that many of the images were familiar to me from many other documentaries I've seen in the past. But I always thought about these images as if they were like objective documentation of history. This history was inventing its own images. I never thought about the fact that they were produced by a specific cameraman, by a specific film crew with a specific agenda. And only when I started to research this film, I understood how our conception of the past is being manipulated by the way we think we know what we see. And gradually, I think, we stopped seeing. We were just looking at this footage. It became this black and white, far away, old images from that dark part of history. And my aim, my goal in making this film was to make the viewer not just look at this footage, but actually see it in a different light, to start to reflect the nature of these images.
So the film shot in 1942, the Nazi propaganda film, which we see in black and white, which is sort of aged and silent, was made in the Warsaw Ghetto, and another reel of film showed up later that showed the outtakes and showed that this supposed documentary about the Warsaw Ghetto was actually very much staged. How did that second reel, well, first of all, how did the first reel survive and get seen? And then tell us about this second reel.
Well, first of all, maybe it's important to mention something which is not included in my film. Josef Goebbels, the minister of propaganda, the Nazi minister of propaganda in the Third Reich, wrote 4 days before the filming of this film began that they are planning to make many films about the Jewish communities inside the ghettos for the sake of their future generations of the Third Reich. I mean, they were not thinking then that they were going to lose the war. They were thinking about the future and how to educate their youngsters about the race of the Jews and the how immoral was the community or rotten and how they lived. So, and I think that this is my own very personal speculation, but after planning this film hundreds of times, I think we're not planning to show it back then in movie theaters, but to use it as an educational material for future purposes. So they were archiving it inside one of their film vaults, and this was one of the film vaults that were not bombed during the last days of the war. It was in East Berlin, and there it was discovered after the war in 1954. The outtakes were discovered in the United States. It was discovered in 1998 by two film researchers who were seeking to find more footage from the 36 Olympic Games in Germany. And just by chance, they spotted these two film cans lying on the floor with a title on them, The Ghetto. And since they knew very well the 62 minutes sequence that was discovered in 54 in Germany, when they saw the outtakes, they could immediately match the outtakes to the original film. And this was the first time when we could see the film crew entering the frame and to see how they were actually walking. And it really changes the way we understand what we see. I'll just give a short example. In the film, there is a scene which I saw so many times before I saw the whole sequence of this footage of women descending into a ritual bath, and they are naked. And when I saw it in a Polish museum years ago, it was titled Jewish Ritual Life Inside the Ghetto. This sequence was showing part of the Jewish ritual that the Jews used to practice in their normal or like during their life in their closed community. When I saw this scene in the footage, I suddenly started to realize that these naked women were kidnapped in the street, were forced to undress, and while they were filmed, they were surrounded by uniformed men pointing cameras at them. And suddenly the horror became much more close to me just by understanding that I'm seeing women under the influence of an anxiety attack. And I could not see the painful expression on their faces when this footage was titled Jewish Ritual Life Inside the Ghetto. So this is what the outtakes can do for a viewer. It reflects the way the image is produced and helps us to understand what we actually see in it.
So, was this film ever actually used, do we know, as propaganda in Germany?
It was never. What I know is that this is the only version that was found, and it's very clear that it is an unfinished version. This is a working draft. There is no opening titles, no ending credits, no sound. It is roughly. We don't know if there is more advanced. It was not discovered yet. And as far as I know, it was never screened in Germany in any circumstances.
One of the things that's amazing about it is that there is a whole narration of a diary by a man who was in the Warsaw Ghetto, who documented his life and this film as it was being filmed. It's extraordinary that these diaries survived and that you were able to use them in your film.
Most of the diaries that are being quoted in the film were part of a huge historical project made by the historian Manuel Ringelblum, who was aiming to establish an archive of written material by all kinds of people that were living in the ghetto for future generations, because he understood that it might be the last chapter of this community and they must write now what is happening for people in the future to know what was going on there. And before he was murdered, he succeeded to hide all these diaries under the ground inside the Warsaw Ghetto. After the war, two of his assistants who survived the war managed to locate the hiding place and to rescue three quarters of this archive. I think it contains something like 9,000 documents. And it is considered to be one of the greatest archives, one of the greatest testimonies, written testimonies from that time of the Jewish community.
We're talking to Yael Hersonsky. Her film is called A Film Unfinished. It's painful to watch it, and part of what you do is you have people who are witnesses, who were there watching the film, in your film, and maybe they're going to see somebody they know, or maybe they're going to see a relative, but it was very familiar to them. And I thought about this whole question of stirring up those memories, bringing them up again. There's one woman who says now she can cry. When she was there, she couldn't. And I was wondering if you could talk about this whole question of what it means to go back to such a painful time in the life of somebody who is now an old person.
Yeah, well, I believe that they don't go back. They're still living that past. The past is still passing for them. When they first talked to me about the possibility of watching this footage, not all of the survivors I could locate agreed to watch it, and some of them hesitated. Even those who hesitated, I told them, I prefer you won't come, because I felt that I could not take the responsibility to show someone with so, not only, I mean, they're strong in their spirit, but they're already fragile in their bodies. And I felt it's too much to bear. Those who were interviewed for this film were the only ones who insisted on watching this footage, because they felt it might be their last chance to have their final word on this silent images, which were staged by the Nazis. So for them, it was their own personal mission to have their own comments, to see with their own eyes, to judge with their own eyes how it was for them. And for me, it was an overwhelmingly exciting I was completely shaken by this experience of watching them, who were children then and were probably somewhere a few meters from the borders of the frame, to see them having a second chance to comment what they're watching. So it was powerful, it was difficult, but all of them thanked us, the Israeli film crew, for letting them experiencing this, because they felt a relief. They felt that they did something not only for a film, but for themselves, being able to talk, still to be here and alive and to talk about these images.
When I was watching the film and the conditions in the Warsaw Ghetto and the overcrowding and the lack of food and not being able to leave, I was thinking, and please forgive me if this is not a direction you want to go, but I was thinking about the current situation in Gaza, and I was wondering, do you see parallels, or were you thinking about parallels when you made the film?
When I first started this journey, actually my initial starting point was the numbness that attacks viewers in Israel whenever they see whatever is going on in the occupied territories. I mean, I felt we're so close to these places, and we see the images all every day, and we And it's very, very hard emotionally to digest whatever we see. And I think that the situation today, where images became our reality, and a reality in which we cannot, or we feel we cannot interfere. We're just passive viewers in our living rooms, saying, "Oh dear," most of the time, but not doing anything. I think that part of this numbness is another stage in a process that began when the first images from World War II were shown in the world. I mean, it, a certain amount of violence, which the world hasn't seen before, gradually became more evident and more and more. It was shown in more ways, and today it's a situation of a bombardment of images of violence till the point one cannot feel anything anymore. I was hoping that by changing something in our perception about these atrocious images from our past, maybe we can also look at the suffering of our neighbors in a fresh way. Maybe we can at least start and reflect how limited we are as viewers, and how more can we know, and how more can we reach out to the people who are suffering during this very moment, just by not accepting whatever is being edited by seeking for a better truth in our own way.
Yael Hersansky is a filmmaker. Her documentary is called A Film Unfinished. It opens this Friday, the 12th of November, at Regal de Vargas Cinema. We've been talking to her through her cell phone in Israel, which is why the sound has been a little rough. But thank you, listeners, for sitting through it. And thank you so much, Yael, for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.